I frightened myself on the way over here. I'm here to talk about the system of spiritual life. And for some reason the thought came into my mind, well, this situation itself is a situation of a practice. Of course for you, but for me. And that in sort of thinking about giving you a presentation, I've also got to look at myself in relation to giving that presentation. I prefer not to have this talk, the thought, just before walking in. I've got experience, I've got knowledge, I've been taught by Sangharakshita, by others, especially by Sangharakshita, and my duty is to try to communicate something of what I've learnt to you, in case you don't already know it. But the medium is the message, and the way in which I communicate and the way in which you receive that communication is as important as the content of what I've got to say. So that's what I frighten myself with, that sort of consideration, that this is a situation of practice where all those five elements of a complete spiritual life need to be in play. I'm not going to stand here and analyse everything I'm saying as I go along in terms of those five, because that would be impossibly circular. But nonetheless, it's worth reflecting for a moment that every situation is an arena for practice, for practice and realisation, for expression of the Dhamma, and this as much as any other, for me and for you. I need to get out of the way of the Dhamma so that it can come across to you. You need to get out of the way of it coming to you, because your own prejudices, your own predilections, your own responses may prevent you from hearing what I've got to say, just as my own concern that you think I'm wonderful and so forth and so on may prevent me from communicating it to you. So, some preliminary thoughts. Yesterday I was really trying to stress that this spiritual life, this spiritual practice, to use that term, that we're exploring, these aspects of a complete spiritual life, are concerned with going beyond ourselves. It's concerned with getting to the point at which we can allow the Dhamma to express itself through us in a completely spontaneous a natural way, which is really, in a sense, nothing to do with us, you could say, to be rhetorical about it. It's not about me, it's not about I, not about my preferences, not about my likes, my dislikes. It's important to stress this because of the whole bias of our modern culture, certainly in the West. In India, one often has to stress almost the opposite of that, because people see things so much in terms of fitting in to social convention, being accepted. We do that here, of course, but we have so much latitude to pursue our own whims and fancies. And the great difficulty for us in leading a Dhamma life is to give that up, give up individualism. I think it's still the most difficult task that faces us in trying to bring the Dhamma to life in the West. Because, as I said yesterday, it's very easy to assimilate shallow notions of the Dhamma to Western individualism, post-European Enlightenment individualism, which of course has given the world a great deal, but and yet still gives us the danger of isolating ourselves, guiding our lives simply by our own whim and fancy, what we term individualism. So I was trying to stress that what we're aiming at is something that goes way beyond I, that isn't really to do with your own likes and dislikes. I referred yesterday to that talk of Bhante's enlightenment as experience and non-experience. And this morning I went and read it, and I'm quite surprised at how stunningly relevant it is right now, as it were. And I strongly recommend it again to everybody to have a look at it. Anyway, the climax of the talk, Bhante's talking about what enlightenment as non-experience means. And he said you could think of it best in terms of three qualities or three factors, in terms of three words. Those words are growth, which perhaps speaks for itself, in terms of work, and in terms of duty. So these are not very popular terms for thinking about a Dhamma life, for thinking about a spiritual life. But if you are intending to enter the order, if you really seriously want to enter the order, I think you need to get to grips, especially with those latter two terms, and imbue them with a relevance which is not one that might be what immediately springs to mind. Work, of course, means service of the Dhamma, that you give your life to serving the Dhamma, and you try to make everything that you do a part of that service. Duty means, well, Bhante quotes Goethe, duty is serving the needs of the day. So it's doing what needs to be done. Of course, that's not a simple matter to decide what needs to be done. But it's not doing simply what I want to do in a superficial sense. So in talking about spiritual practice, in talking about the five aspects of spiritual practice, I wanted to be quite clear, I'm talking in this context of laying ourselves aside, not of course in a superficial or trivial sense, or denying ourselves, or because we hate ourselves, or something like that, but in giving ourselves up to something that's greater than ourselves, that's more true, more deep. This will come out, I hope, more and more as we proceed with the considerations. So yes, I wanted to start by putting things in this larger context, and particularly in the larger context of our collective experience of something that goes beyond us. I talked about my experience at Pamaloka and in many other places, my experience with the order, with the movement, of at their best there being a sense of something that's greater than us as individuals. So that when we're together, we feel as if we're tuned in to something that goes way beyond us as individuals. So that's the first point that I really wanted to get across, that when we're talking, when we're thinking about these things, we're not thinking in terms of merely my preferences. We're thinking of going beyond those in an intelligent, integrated way. Now, the second preliminary point I want to make, which will probably be the major substance of what I have to say, how do you do it? How do you set about this process of transcending yourself, of giving yourself up to something that is greater than yourself in a way that is not merely the kind of suppression of yourself or the slavery of yourself, but which is giving yourself up to something that is more than self? What fundamentally are we doing in pursuing our spiritual life? What are we working with in practicing the Dhamma? And I think this needs to be far more widely and better understood. We need to understand the fundamental forces of life which we are cooperating with, which we're calling upon in order to take ourselves forward in the Dhamma. In religious traditions generally, of course, the force that people usually think of is a god of some sort. And they think of calling upon eternal forces to carry them forward. They think in terms of obeying the commandments or subordinating themselves to those divine powers, what in Buddhism we term eternalism. And although there's some sort of truth in that, it's only part of the story. Of course, outside the religious sphere, and particularly in the modern context, and this is probably what most of us are more in danger of still being subject to, we believe that fundamentally that the universe is governed in a sense by chance, by blind forces that have no purpose, no teleology, that have no end, that are random and in a sense meaningless. That of course is nihilism, which is the zeitgeist, I think. Whatever people may pay lip service to, fundamentally, most people in the modern West are nihilists. They believe that matter is the primary substance, that consciousness is a sort of chance electrical glow on the surface of matter, and that it has no fundamental meaning. And that in the end, all you can do is try to get some happiness, some fulfillment from this life. Well, these two extremes are really the major possibilities along which most of us find our thinking spread or our unconscious motivation spread. We think in terms of trying to subordinate ourselves to a divine power, not very common these days, or we think in terms of getting the best we can out of a random universe until the lights finally go out. And, these guide our behaviour. Famously, eternalism leads to self-suppression, self-torture, extreme asceticism, which the Buddha himself eschewed before he sat under the Bodhi tree. Materialism, nihilism, leads to hedonism. You think that there's no real purpose, no fundamental, no ultimate purpose to your life, so you just try to get the best you can out of it while you can. And every action that we take has some reference, unconsciously, semi-consciously, or maybe even consciously, to some sort of view about the fundamental mechanisms of things. Whenever we take a step, whenever we make a decision, we're unconsciously or consciously or semi-consciously referring to a view about the way life is. And most commonly today, that view is that it really doesn't amount to anything. I think this infects Buddhists as much as anybody. Perhaps more than many. I think it infects our movement even. We're all so strongly conditioned by the nihilism, the materialistic nihilism of our days. And it leads us always to take an individualistic, soft option, to find the way of getting at least some pleasure, some comfort, some happiness, some mild fulfillment while we can. Very difficult in those circumstances to sustain a larger purpose, a larger moral, even spiritual purpose, to call it that. So what is it lies between these two extremes? Well, of course, we know it's the middle way. It's the view of life, of all our experience, as governed by conditioned processes. All of life, all experience is a congeries, an amalgam, very complex interaction of conditioned processes. None of which are ultimately stable, none of which are fixed, although all of which follow regularities. So when you look at the total complex of conditioned processes, you can see patterns. You can see that when you're at least on this earth or on a heavy body and you drop something, it will fall to the ground. And that will invariably happen unless, you know, other conditions come into play which make it fly up, whatever they might be, if you go up into the above the Earth's atmosphere and so on. But when certain conditions are there, you can rely on certain laws, to put it that way. Law, of course, is not law in the judicial sense or even in the divine sense. It's simply an observation of regularity. You can see that under certain circumstances, something will happen. This is the fundamental Buddhist insight, that all life is governed by, is a process of conditioning, of conditioned arisings, and everything that arises in dependence on conditions, and those conditions conform to regularities. I don't know why, it doesn't matter, that just happens. There's no attempt to explain that, because such explanations, well, they're philosophically problematic. We won't go into that now, because you've got to take a viewpoint outside those processes, which, well, where do you go? So, yes, all life is governed by conditioned processes. And we can see, according to later Buddhism, which is derived from early Buddhism, we can see that there are five major sets of regularity. Five niyamas. Niyama does simply mean law. It's in modern Indian languages, it means, for instance, you'd have the law of gravity, which would be something or other niyama. So these niyamas are really not so much single laws. They're sets of laws that have a certain kind of regularity. So there are laws that govern physical matter. The laws of gravity. My science is pretty rudimentary, so I suppose electromagnetism. That those sorts of laws, that this kind of laws that you study in physics and chemistry. It really does pretty much correspond to physics and chemistry. So there's laws for governing our bodies. There are physical processes. You know, I'm staying on this chair because of the law of gravity, and so on. There are physical laws at work within my body, within your bodies, within this room. There are also there are biological processes, biological laws, niyamas, a niyama that covers all of those. So in my body there's the laws that govern the translation of oxygen into the bloodstream and so on and so forth, reproduction of cells, all of that at the organic level. Then there are laws that govern the emergence of, govern mind in the sense of sense perception and instinct. These complex processes whereby I can assemble in my mind a picture of all of you out there, and you can assemble a picture of me over here. And then more instinctive processes that govern the way in which, well, for instance, swallows come from South Africa, come back to Great Britain, if we're lucky. I live in Wales, and there's a little stream running through where I live, and every now and again an eel comes through. And apparently those eels are the descendants of eels that left that stream. I don't know whether it's last year or sometime or other. No GPS, no map, no instruction. Instinct finds their way back. So those are the laws that are governed that come under the heading of what is called manoniyama, mental conditionality. But it's mental in the more instinctive sense, in the animal sense, covered by, I suppose, stimulus response kind of psychology, by animal psychology, that sort of thing. All these processes that are going on within us, autonomous processes that are, in a sense, not much within our control. We can affect them, but we can't directly choose to have them or not have them. They just happen. So all of these are well studied and well understood, really, and increasingly studied and understood more and more finely. And a lot of research nowadays, isn't there, into the relationship between brain states and mental experience and so on. And most of which comes under the heading of manoniyama, which actually affects us far more strongly than we like to think. I'll have more to say about that tomorrow. So then, We've got these physical, chemical, utu niyama, it's called in Pali, processes. We've got bija niyama, biological processes. We've got mano niyama, which is lower psychological or zoological processes, governing perception, instinct, and so on. But, of course, evolution throws up this strange ability to identify ourselves, to say I, and to stand outside the processes of time, to stand outside the processes of interaction between an organism and its surroundings, and to think I will, I do, I see, I hear, which is, from an evolutionary point, an enormous step forward, because it enables us to, a great augmentation of intelligence. It allows us to build very complex pictures of the world, to plan in a very complex and elaborate way the future, to learn from the past. But what is perhaps far less widely understood is the way in which that kind of awareness, that self-awareness, generates a new kind of conditioning. You find sort of chance references to it. You can see it implied in modern works of psychology and so forth, but you never see it really spelled out, as far as I'm aware. I'm not very up in these things. But in Buddhism, it's particularly clearly delineated as karma niyama. The laws, the set of laws, the regularities that govern the way in which the experienced individual, the experienced agent, interacts with the world around. The way in which your conscious decisions modify the world around you and modify you. When we say conscious, it doesn't necessarily mean thought, if you see what I mean, or very clearly conscious. We're very adept at fooling ourselves about our real motives. But nonetheless, there is some sort of peripheral awareness of them. It's an issue that needs a lot more detail, but just to nod in that direction. So we are governed by processes which we define as karma niyama, conditioned processes that come into play when we identify ourselves. And as I said yesterday, the most significant thing about those conditioned processes is that they not only modify the world around us, they modify us. They modify our own internal experience, our experience of ourselves. They modify our own emerging minds, our consciousness. You know the very obvious examples. You know the way in which you get really upset and annoyed with somebody and you're left with a bad taste in your mouth. I hope you are anyway. For some time afterwards, you feel sort of dirtied by your own loss of mindfulness, or your own loss of control. Or, you find yourself just sort of following some line of craving, and you find yourself doing something that you really would rather that you hadn't done, and you feel the sort of the sullying effect of that upon you. You feel different. This is one of the problems of the internet, isn't it? The gap between desire and action is so short. You can hardly know that you've pressed that button and you're there, whether it's to buy something you really didn't need or other things we won't even mention. But you all know what I mean. It's very, very easy. And you don't want to do it, but you've done it and you feel the effect upon you. So we're all the time modifying our own inner experience through our decisions. Of course, it's very obvious that we modify the world around us. When you hit somebody, and they hit you back. It's a bit obvious. But the effect, the internal effect, is less obvious to us, or less clearly conscious to us. And we're not taught it. It really is the most fundamental thing that a human being needs to be taught, It's sort of surprising that the law of karma isn't the you know, sort of at the top of the curriculum. I suppose it probably is in some vague roundabout way. But I think what's so useful about the Buddhist approach is that it's approached on an analogy, if you like, with scientific laws that we already know. We know about the law of karma, of gravity. We know about the way in which when you drop something, it falls to the ground. Well, there's an equivalence, it's not exactly equivalent, about the way in which your own actions modify yourself. And I think that really we ought to be taught this very, very squarely. And it's this type of conditionality that is certainly in the early stages the major power we draw on in our spiritual lives. And we need to make it much more conscious that that's what we're doing. We're working with natural processes that are, so to speak, built in, so to speak. Nobody did it. They're just there, just as the law of gravity is just there. They're part of the way things are, and we draw on in order to grow as individuals. Our growth is as natural as the growth of a plant. You know, when you plant the seed, the right conditions, up comes the plant. Just the same with our own moral and even dhammic lives. If we create the conditions, act within those conditions, the result naturally comes, at least in the end. And it's that we rely on. So I think that a very important question to debate, if you haven't already done so, in your discussion groups, is the extent to which you're really convinced of this. The extent to which you're really convinced that the law of karma is something to be relied upon, that you can make it the basis of your life, that you can rely on that when you can't rely on anything else. When everything else deserts you, the one thing you can be confident of is that if you act skillfully, you will get a good result. You will grow as a human being. Incidentally, in one way or another, conditions will begin to improve around you, although that's a more complex judgment because conditions are very complex. But in general, if you act in accordance with karma, life will begin to be smoother for you. You'll move through it with less disturbance, less opposition. But that, as I say, doesn't mean that bricks won't fall on your head and cancer may not start up in your body. Dreadful things can happen to good people as much as to bad, just as good things can happen to bad people, so to speak. But the thing you can be sure of is that your inner experience will unfold. And this is the fundamental confidence that you need to have if you're to lead a Dhamma life. If you're going to go for refuge to the Three Jewels, if you're going to go for refuge to the Three Jewels effectively, this is what you have to rely on. You have to rely on the forces of karma. It's probably all very old hat to you, but I want to stress it because I think it bears reflection again and again and again. Where do you think even your happiness is really going to come from? Every time you do something that gives you immediate gratification, as it were, you've abnegated the principle of karma. You've consciously or unconsciously sort of said, sod it, I want something now. It's okay, chocolate's good. But when it becomes a sort of way of life, which it can do, you fill in for chocolate whatever you want, and when that starts to guide your life, you're basically giving up on the law of karma. If you really rely on the law of karma, if you believe fully in the law of karma, you will know that in every situation your best interest lies in skillful states of mind and the actions that emerge from them. Of course, it's not always an easy thing to know what skillful states of mind mean or how to get to them, But nonetheless, in sum, it's quite simple. So we need to be completely convinced that there is a set of regularities within life that we can absolutely rely upon that will mean our skillful efforts will lead to growth. And in the end, to a more gratifying, more fulfilled life. Much struggle, much devil in that detail. But in broad, this is what we're relying upon. And everything I'm going to say about the aspects of a full spiritual life refers to the principle of karma. And I'll be coming back again and again to this. But I'd like you all to really reflect on your own clarity about that principle of karma. Be quite sure that you do know what it means, and that, you know, all the various anomalies and so forth, what's been called the Glenn Hoddle Michaditi is quite clear to you. Oh, there was another sporting figure who made this error again. Well, who was that? Somebody. Oh dear, I can't remember who it was. Somebody announced that people who were disabled, it's quite recent, wasn't it? Had to apologise. Oh, no, yeah, that's right. It was an American congressman who had to withdraw from the recent elections because he'd said that, I can't remember exactly what it was, I think it was people with disabilities, they've only themselves to blame for their past actions. But those ideas about karma are there, sort of very bad interpretations of bad ideas within Hinduism or Tibetan Buddhism. Some Tibetan Buddhists seem to have these sort of ideas. It's not proper Tibetan Buddhism. But yeah, be quite clear. Do you really know what it means? Because it's the fundamental of your life. If you're buying into this, in this going for refuge, if you're really going to dedicate your life to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, the assumption is you're going to live with, on the basis of karma. That's the force you're going to use, just as an engineer uses the force of gravity and the laws of thermodynamics in building a bridge. You're building your spiritual life on the basis of the laws of karma. So, yeah, are you really into it? Or do you really believe it? Or do you secretly believe, actually, it's all random? And, you know, maybe if you act well, it'll be a little bit good, but, you know, it's not really where it's at. Or do you really believe that there is some divine force that is governing everything? That you need to sort out. And of course, for most of us, there's conscious, less conscious, and unconscious attitudes. And those you need to go through. And we need to identify the wrong views, the misunderstandings about karma, and make sure we really clarify our minds about them. It's the basis for what you come here to commit yourselves to. And then there's less conscious ones where there's a bit mixed up, little bits of semi-deliberate turning the blind eye. And then there's unconscious patterns that are bred into us, maybe from leftover Christianity, Judaism, Islam on the one hand, or from a materialistic nihilism, consumerist attitudes, individualistic consumerism that, well, is the primary religion of our times. No Hindus probably, but that's a different matter. Hindus believe basically that everything does depend upon the gods, but you just have to bribe them sufficiently and they'll be on your side. And popular Hinduism is a system of corruption, which is interesting because it also dominates Indian public life as well. So yes, what are the unconscious attitudes you bring to your life? The unconscious ideas about how life is governed. The laws that govern life. You really need to think about this very deeply and convince yourself more and more thoroughly, both intellectually by getting clear about what the teaching is and experientially just sort of examining what you do. See the way in which when you do something that even in the doing of it, you know you shouldn't do for your own benefit. See what's underlying that. See what belief structures underlie it. Remember In Buddhism, it's said that view is primary, this sort of emotio-cognitive complex that underlies all our behaviour. These ways of thinking, these ways of understanding that are not just thinking, they're feeling, they're often not articulate at all. But in those views, there will be a fundamental attitude to the meaning and purpose of life, a fundamental attitude to what makes life move, why things happen, how happiness arises, how fulfillment arises. So look, those levels, conscious, intellectual, understanding, less conscious, automatic habits and so forth, and deeper unconscious habits and patterns. You know, if you have had a strong religious upbringing, perhaps from something like Catholicism or whatever, it doesn't seem so common these days in our movement. It used to be de rigueur. If you weren't an ex-Catholic, you were hardly a Buddhist. but it just doesn't seem very common nowadays, I suppose, because religion is that kind is was so decayed in many ways. I read the other day that Norwich is the most irreligious city in England. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I also was told by a musician that it's the worst place to perform because you don't get any response. It's the same giving a talk, actually. I can think of worse places on the continent, but we won't go there. So, yeah, what are the unconscious patterns you bring that are to do with the way in which life works and then will then guide what you do and that you'll then import into your Buddhist life? And you need to try to base yourself increasingly on karma. That's all you can rely on. The Buddha recommended five reflections for everybody. I'm going to go into these later, but he said that he said that everybody, lay and monk, should reflect on these every day. And the fifth of these is, I am heir to my karma. I am the owner of my karma. Karma is the womb from which I have sprung. Karma is my parents. Karma shapes my future experience. Whatever action I perform now, whether skillful or unskillful, of that I will be heir in the future. Karma is my only refuge. It's only on karma that you can rely. When you die, your only thing you're left with is your karma. Your bank account is empty. So this is the first of these forces that we draw upon, the major force that we draw upon, the major pattern of conditionality that we draw upon. And I'd like you to really look deeply into yourself, your own understanding and your own practice in relation to this. But there's another force, another set of regularities that are a little bit more difficult to understand or get to grips with. But the best way you could approach this is by asking, what are the conditions, independence upon which Buddhas arise? Because the Buddha says that everything that arises in dependence on conditions. So what are the conditions that give rise to Buddhahood, to enlightenment, to Bodhi? It's not karma, because karma is to do with I. It's to do with self-identification. But Buddhahood is to do with transcending I. So there's a fifth nyama, a fifth set of regularities, which are, as I say, much more difficult to understand, which are referred to as dharma niyama. These are natural processes, natural conditioned processes, as it were, built into life. Not that anybody built them in. That are part of the way things are. That when you have the right conditions, they naturally come into play. And they're different from karma. Because karma, if you act skillfully, leads to growth. But that growth is dependent upon self, upon making a willed effort. Dharma processes, processes that arise under the Dharma Niyama category, take place when you drop self-clinging, when you stop being attached to I, when you let go of yourself, then something emerges, as it were, within you. States arise within you, actions arise within you that don't have a self-reference. Maybe that sounds a bit obscure, but in a way it's not that obscure. We probably all have some small taste of it, even if we don't have the full-blown experience. Moments when you just spontaneously respond. You know, perhaps you see some need. You see that somebody's in pain or something like that, and you just move forward. You don't think, I will help him. You just move forward. You know, that sort of situation where you see an accident in the road. I don't know whether you kind of notice this yourself. You find an instant sort of inner reaction to go towards, to help. And you sort of have to think, well, is it useful? Can I really do anything? And so on. But it's a quite spontaneous sort of move to help. Or you see somebody in trouble, trying to lift something. You just go forward to help. You don't think about it. Now, I'm not saying this is dharma niyama. Maybe, it may not be. But I'm just trying to give you an analogy for this sense of a simple response. It's your duty. In Bhante's, the phrase that I evoke, that I read off this morning. It's where you see something needs to be done, you do it. It's not altruistic, because altruism, in a way, is the decision to let go of self. It's looking at other. Dharma niyama, it's not to do with either self or other. You just respond. There's a need, you respond. And your mental states arise without a self-reference. Very difficult to really get a grip on what this means when you start to analyse it. But yes, if you think in terms of this completely spontaneous response to the situation. Probably some of you have read my recent paper, A Suprapersonal Force, and I make no apology for telling the story in that sort of prefaces or is the point of departure for my paper. I tell the story of Sangharakshita arriving in Nagpur on the 6th of December 1956, the place where Dr. Ambedkar had converted to Buddhism, to learn the news that Dr. Ambedkar was dead, just 5 or 6 weeks after he'd converted, with millions of people converting in his wake, his grandfather and grandmother and so on. And just an absolute catastrophe, unbelievable, unimaginable disaster for those people who were mostly illiterate, desperate poverty, terribly oppressed in the villages, even in the towns, living in slums if they were in the towns, bonded labourers in the villages. They'd all gained such confidence from Dr. Ambedkar. Gone. So Sangharakshita, over the course of the next 3 or 4 days, gave talk after talk after talk. And it's a long story about which much could be told. But he wrote later to a friend reporting his experience during that time. And he said something like, my whole experience during that time was most peculiar, unusual, strange. He said, I felt that I was not a person, but an impersonal force. And he said, at times I was speaking just as if I was in samadhi, without any premeditation, without any thought. I was just speaking. And of course, I know people who were there and heard him. What he said was exactly what they needed to hear. And he said that when he left Nagpur, after so much strain, very little sleep, he felt completely rested, completely at ease. So to me, that's a very good and simple example of what we mean by this Dhamma Niyama kind of experience. What level it was at, let's not even bother to speculate. But it was something of that kind of experience, of just being drawn out of himself by the situation, by the terrible need of people around him, just forgetting himself and responding. In that response, finding energy just pouring through him, flowing through him, and giving people exactly what they needed, but not as if he was giving it. When he tells the story, I've heard him talk about this directly, he sort of tells it with a sense of surprise almost, of wonder, not as something that he did or that was an achievement for him, but that something sort of more happened to him. That's the nature of that experience. It's not mine. It's not anybody else's, of course. It's not some, you know, divine force being channeled, or if it is a divine force, only in the most highly poetic manner. It's a transition in consciousness, so that consciousness is no longer predicated upon I is there, of course, because otherwise you couldn't get your breakfast and do anything, because you have to sort of I is a function of the structure of consciousness, which is sort of built in, if you like, by the whole mechanism of perception and consciousness awareness. But there's no attachment to that. No sense that this is the most important thing. It's the whole field of consciousness opens up and you just respond. And these Dharma Niyama processes, once they begin to unfold in a decisive way, grow, they augment. Again, without effort, they simply naturally overflow. More flows into still more into greater still, and so on, until enlightenment itself, at which point it's difficult to say how we can talk about it. So these Dharma Niyama processes are characterized especially by the moment when we break through our self-clinging, especially when we break through it decisively, when we really understand the conditioned, the constructed nature of our self-clinging, not just intellectually, but emotionally, and we let go of it, at least to some extent. Still there, operative, but with less and less effective within us. So that's Dhamma Niyama processes at their most fully manifest. But they begin to play upon us well before that. If it wasn't for Dhamma Niyama processes, I don't see how we could be here. I don't see how we could be sitting here in this shrine room with this figure of the Buddha, listening patiently to an attempt to expound the Dhamma. How could we do it if we didn't feel something of what goes beyond I? So we feel it, first of all, as a pull of faith, you could say. A sort of tugging, well, you could say, in your heart, although people are so different. Sometimes it's experiences, probably more my own way of experiencing it, as an absolutely incontrovertible kind of fact, a truth that you just cannot deny, that's greater, as it were, than your own truth, and that puts you into perspective. Yes, but it may be experienced as something really deeply attractive that you're just drawn towards, that draws you on, almost you know not where. It may be experienced in other ways too, something you must do, something that has to be done by you, that is more than you. So these Dhamma Niyama processes are present, in a way, from the outset of our spiritual lives, of Dhamma lives. They couldn't not be, because otherwise how could it be a Dhamma life? So we gradually allow those Dhamma Niyama forces to move us forward, and we use Karma Niyama processes to get out of their way. Basically, what you could put it like that. Karma Niyama processes help us to free up our self-attachment. That's fundamentally what skillful action does. It frees us up from our self-attachment. It brings us into a stronger and stronger sense of interaction with the world around us, and a stronger and stronger sense that we are not the sum and limit of it all. We experience it in friendship, the sense that of the other as deeply significant as the self. We experience it in work, the task, the purpose, the shared ambition is greater than us. how we experience it in our reflection on the Dhamma, a sense that we're moving into truths that go beyond us, even deny us in a certain sense. We experience it in a sense of devotion to figures or symbols that embody something greater than ourselves, such as the Buddha. So we get out of the way by practicing skillful karma. And that skillful karma, taken far enough, leads us to the point where we can decisively break the hold of that self-clinging that's so deeply embedded in us. And that those Dhamma Niyama processes can naturally, spontaneously unfold within us. Up till then, they've been sort of struggling with our self-clinging. It's almost as if there's a wind trying to blow us along in a certain direction, but we're rowing hard against it. And to begin with, that our rowing is so powerful, so strong, we're so heavy that the wind can't move us. So we reverse the trend and reverse the direction and row ourselves more and more with that wind. So these two sets of processes, karma and dharma, are the fundamentals of everything I'm going to be speaking about. And I'd really like you to talk tomorrow about that and to try to clarify them for yourselves. Don't sentimentalize them, don't lay claim to what you don't experience or try to force yourself to experience something you don't experience or feel bad because you don't experience it. But try to see what you really do understand and whether you do have some sense of how those two forces work in your lives, how you're living in relation to them. Because they're the basis of ordination. Ordination is when you effectively commit yourself to working with those two sets of processes. When you go for refuge effectively, you are committing yourself to acting more and more skillfully. You're saying, I believe that karma is the fundamental force of my moral life, and you're committing yourself to working with it. And you're saying that I believe that Dhamma processes are the real meaning of my life, and I'm committed to opening myself up to them, giving myself up to them. That's really what you're doing when you're ordained. You're letting go of other views, other attitudes. You're letting go of compromises, of half-truths, of partial solution, of shortcuts. And you're undertaking the long, slow process of transforming yourself through karma so that dharma can unfold within you. So, yes, I think tomorrow I'd like to ask you to make that the principal focus. Just making sure you really do know what these mean. Not just theoretically, although theoretically is very important, but also experientially. And I'm not suggesting that anybody has or has not a strong experience of Dhamma Niyama processes. But you have some experience, otherwise why on earth are you here? If you didn't have some attraction to the Buddha, the Buddha as representing something bigger than you, or to the Dharma as representing something more than you, what on earth are you doing here? Save yourself some trouble. Go and have some fun. Save us some trouble too. Trying to work it out. You're committing yourself to those two processes. And if you could be said in Buddhism to believe in anything, it's in these two kinds of process. And your conviction or lack of conviction in them is what in the end will govern your success. So I hope that I've brought your minds at least to something that's probably very familiar to you, or ought to be very familiar to you. Probably some it is familiar to and some not. I certainly myself consider that these need to be much better understood and studied, because I think we're so much dominated by unconscious ideas about the mechanisms of life, that we're all the time being taught in our upbringing and in the advertising, everything that we're influenced by is usually pronouncing nihilism to us. And we need to be very clear where we stand in all this if we want to go for refuge effectively. So tomorrow I'll move on to discussing the detail of how we work with these processes. Especially tomorrow I'll be looking at integration. I'll be looking at the first of these five aspects that are the fundamentals of our life. But I want to be dealing with them in this context. Dhamma life is not about technique. It's not about practices. In a way, it's not even about lifestyle or anything of that kind. It's not about words and names and so on. It's about activating these two processes, these two kinds of process. And everything we do must be referable to them, so that we're always able to understand, I'm doing this because through this I'm developing a more skillful, I'm developing skillful attitudes from which a more expanded self will emerge. And we always need to be able to refer back in that way and understand, even if the understanding is that we sort of don't understand, and that's because we're opening to something that's more than us, if you see what I mean. Otherwise we end up so rational about it all that it defeats itself. So that's where we'll go tomorrow, but I hope that you've got a very strong theme for today. Thank you.